This is an ABC podcast.
The Western Australian Government acknowledges the cultural significance of the loss of an ancient Indigenous site on a mine site in the remote Pilbara.
Clearly the Aboriginal people are very upset about what's been lost, and it certainly appears from the statement they've released that this was a very significant site, not just for Aboriginal people, but I suspect for the archaeological history of Australia.
And a Kangaroo Island resident describes to the Royal Commission the power and destruction of the January fires.
These asbestos houses that have burnt have exploded. Now, I thought asbestos was supposed to be sort of a bit of a firewall.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. There are calls for major changes to Western Australia's Aboriginal Heritage Act after a significant 46,000-year-old culturally significant site in the remote Pilbara was legally allowed to be destroyed over the weekend. Rio Tinto has confirmed the destruction of two rock shelters, where archaeologists found an incredible array of artefacts, including plaited human hair and the oldest examples of bone tools in Australia. Karen Mitchell-Moore has the story.
Traditional owner Birchall Hayes says the first his community heard about the planned destruction of two important rock shelters at Juukan Gorge near Tom Price was when they happened to call Rio Tinto to seek permission to visit for NAIDOC Week.
The only reason and why we found out is that our office, the corporation, requested a visit out to that particular site over NAIDOC Week. And that was the first time that we heard that the site was going to be impacted by a blast within the next few days. It saddens us that something that we've got a deep connection to has been destroyed. It's terrible. That site for us, that's where our ancestors were. Occupying their traditional land, and from generation to generation, stories have been passed down to us around that occupation, and even going through and do excavations in those areas to find the plaited hair and the artefacts and how they've been dated back to over 46,000 years. It's something that we will always remember, and traditionally we hand that down to the next generation, but in this case we won't have anything to show the next generation.
Traditional owners, the Puutu Kunti Kurrama people, have long had a successful working relationship with Rio Tinto, spanning three decades. But even they were shocked by the destruction, especially as Rio Tinto had funded an archaeological salvage operation 6 years ago, which had revealed the true significance of the site and that it was far more ancient than previously thought.
You know, while we'd like to think we've got a good relationship with Rio Tinto, I think there is areas for improvement, and one of those is communication between the traditional owner, the Kurrama people, and Rio Tinto.
Dr. Michael Slack was an archaeologist working on the site. He says the objects uncovered were staggering and dated human occupation in the region back more than four times what was originally understood.
This site was something special. It was a massive cave. It has such a rich cultural deposit, such an old occupation, and so significant in that respect that, you know, it's the sort one of those sites that you only excavate sort of maybe once or twice in a career. Myself and the other guys, the other archaeologists and obviously the traditional owners that all sort of slogged it out and sweated for weeks and weeks down the bottom of that pit. We're all taking a moment going, wow, that's just sad, really.
The main issue was that the site's fate had already been decided a year before the archaeological discoveries. In 2013, Rio Tinto was granted ministerial permission to conduct the blasts under the controversial Section 18 of the state's Aboriginal Heritage Act. Traditional owners like Birchall Hayes want that changed.
We're working in a Heritage Act which is about 50 years old, and once Section 18 is granted, then it makes it hard for the traditional owners to unwind that. even on the back of new information around the dating of the artefacts, the hair, and that particular rock shelter as well. So it's not something that you know, I suppose we're happy with. There's no avenue in the current Heritage Act for us to step back and unwind the Section 18.
The state government is in the process of reviewing the Act, and the ABC understands, under the changes, Section 18 would no longer exist. But until it is sorted out, the reality is that other invaluable sites remain vulnerable to loss. Birchall Hayes is urging other traditional owners across the state to be prepared.
Our experience, it's something that we've learnt from, and we didn't believe that we'd ever be in this position. So I'd encourage other traditional owners to ensure that, you know, their mining proponents, whoever's doing any mining activity on their country, is that they understand what they're getting themselves into and do everything that they possibly can to protect their sacred sites.
Karen Mitchell-Moore with that story. Now, in a statement, Rio Tinto has said, Rio Tinto has worked constructively together with the Puutu Kunti, Kurrama and Pinikuru people on a range of heritage matters and has, where practicable, modified its operations to avoid heritage impacts and to protect places of cultural significance to the group. And this morning, WA's Minister for Aboriginal Affairs addressed the media and touched on proposed changes to Aboriginal heritage legislation.
ABC Australia-wide.
It would be really great to see even us bushies out here have access to the diagnostic and treatment services that we really need.
On ABC Radio.
After a day of heated debate between the federal government and the WA state government over the handling of the Al-Kuwait live export ship, WA Premier Mark McGowan has conceded that systems need to improve between the levels of government and the various agencies involved in shipping and border control. Yesterday, it was confirmed that 6 of the 48 crew members of the Al-Kuwait ship had tested positive for COVID-19 after the ship had docked in Fremantle Port. The WA Premier questioned the handling of the case by the federal government and Federal Agricultural Department. But after he received new information about who knew what and when, he struck a more conciliatory tone today.
This morning, I contacted Minister Littleproud to discuss the issue and the need to improve communications between all parties. There have clearly been some errors made all round. We can and must do better, and we will. I'm disappointed that the email from the Federal Department to the FEOC on Friday did not raise red flags inside the Department of Health. In these times, it plainly should have. I also think we need to have better and more comprehensive communications with the Commonwealth than just an email. Any report of crew or passengers on board ships or aircraft entering this state with COVID-like symptoms must be given the attention it deserves.
WA Premier Mark McGowan a short time ago. So what happens now to the 42 crew members that remain on board the Al-Kuwait? They, like many seafarers around the world, have found themselves in impossible situations since the coronavirus pandemic hit. Dean Summers is from the International Transport Workers Federation, who was contacted by the Al-Kuwait crew on Sunday night to say members were sick. Now, Dean Summers, we've heard today about the stuff-ups that led this crew, despite the fact that they did relay ahead that there was issues on board to dock in Fremantle. Given the numbers of vessels that arrive in Australia every day, and many of those from corona hotspots, why are we reliant on crews self-declaring any health issues rather than a more proactive approach?
Well, that's really a question for the Australian Border Force, who has ultimate responsibility on who comes into Australian ports. But we really hasten to add that seafarers can't be criminalised or demonised in this whole process. Seafarers are victims the same as everybody else. They're in very confined quarters for very long periods of time, and they're affected in a whole range of other ways that people probably don't realise.
Did the crew expect to be able to disembark, and did they expect to be in contact with members of the public?
No, they absolutely know, and the same as all the crew around the world, all seafarers, about 1.3 million of them around the world, now understand that in these dark days of COVID-19, there are restrictions around how they can go about their work. Very importantly, they should be able to, by international convention, enjoy a little bit of shore leave, which means they should be, under normal circumstances, able to come down the gangway, go up into town, buy some things, stretch their legs, go to seafarers' missions, etc. But that right has been taken away from them right around the world, so that seafarers are now more or less held captive on board their ships for the entire duration.
So now we've got 42 crew members still on board. What do you know about what's happening with them?
Well, we understand late this afternoon that there's been a move to test more of those. I've been in conversation with the WA state government, and we've been discussing ways to overcome the problem. This is very encouraging because, like the Ruby Princess in New South Wales, we asked the government to get ahead of the problem and not play politics with it. That, unfortunately, was never the case with the Ruby Princess or any of the cruise ships. But it is now the case for the Kuwait, Al Kuwait, and those workers on board that vessel. So we're assured that everyone will be tested. They'll also be tested to see if they have already contracted it and overcome it themselves, in which case there'll be antibodies in their blood. And we'll get a snapshot of how big the problem is now. And then we'll work together as a primary stakeholder with the government and other agencies to try to make sure that this vessel is completely clear and no crew will be exposed to the dangers of COVID-19 before it sails.
So, Dean Summers, can you give me the worst-case scenario and the best-case scenario for this man and this vessel?
Well, the worst-case scenario would be a New South Wales approach where the police commissioner told everybody that that ship, in this case the Ruby Princess, would sail, even though that he knew there were 200 people on board who had tested positive to coronavirus, and that was no care, no consideration. And it was at the direction of the Australian Border Force that ship would sail out of Port Kembla. That's the worst possible thing that could have happened, and that didn't happen because we intervened. In Western Australia, we think the best possible outcome is that the seafarers will be afforded the highest priority, and their health, safety and their dignity too will be observed all the way through, as well as and along with the health and safety of West Australians.
This vessel is working to a strict timetable because there's 50,000 sheep that they were there to pick up, and they all need to leave shore before June 1st, which is coming very, very closely to meet this summer embargo. What's the chances of that ship leaving shore?
Well, I think the logistics are becoming very stark now, and I think the government and the ship owners and others involved in the decision-making processes will be forced with a decision on what's more important: the lives of international transport workers, in this case 48 men, or the fate of those sheep. Now, we think that we can work with state and federal governments and others. We can find replacement crew if necessary. We can seek to extend that moratorium. I think that's probably the most practical thing. I mean, if everyone's got the goodwill in mind of getting the problem fixed, I'm pretty sure that we can do this. I have to say the West Australian government has indicated a very, very positive position on this. It's refreshing to see that seafarers' welfare is in the front of their thinking. And that's where we'll be encouraging them to go. And we'll work with them. The ship has got ITF agreements, industrial agreements. We have our affiliated union in Croatia working with us on this.
So why do you have affiliates in Croatia? Sorry, I don't know what the connection is there.
We are represented by the Croatian Seamen's Union in Croatia, and they have the industrial agreement with this ship.
I see. And the men on board, where do they come from?
Well, the senior officers are Croatian, so the captain and his senior officers are Croatian. Some of the, most of the deck ratings are Filipinos, and the Filipinos, Indonesians, and there's a few Australians. I think the Australian vet and one other Australian is on board, probably through a requirement under the legislation.
What's a green ship?
A green ship is a ship that's been identified for the purposes of COVID-19 as being completely clear of the COVID virus. And that means that everybody on board the ship will be cleared and that the ship would have had deep cleaning. And so that's what we would expect the Al Kuwait to be classed as before she left Fremantle.
And where do you, if there was a new crew to come on board to replace this international crew, because Croatia, Philippines, Indonesia, the crew come from, where would they come from?
Well, there's a lot of seafarers out of work around the world, and there's a lot of seafarers out of work in Fremantle too. So I think when it comes to it, I think we can organise a replacement crew for that, given that everybody is of a mind to fix the problem. So I think that's part of the logistics we have to work through. If we have the management company in Croatia, they can reach out to different countries, as they have done to man this ship, and to have manning agents around different places in the world to put people on this ship. Most of them are normal mariners, but there's quite a lot of people that are used to working with livestock, and they're stockmen. I think there's probably around 30 stockmen on board this ship.
We're living in a time that nobody wants to hear about this kind of miscommunication between state and federal departments that could lead to such serious consequence, not only for the crew, but also for the public. Does this situation on board this ship point to a vulnerability at ports around Australia where the crew just get wrapped up in it?
Well, it sure does. I mean, it really amplifies the problem in the maritime sector. In Australia, an island nation that's completely reliant on shipping for all of our exports and imports, we have no real focus on shipping. And it's a disgrace. We don't have our own shipping fleet. We don't have our own flag. We have very few people participating in the industry. And it's because the governments won't accept that Australia is a nation that's completely reliant on shipping.
Dean Summers, the National Coordinator of International Transport Workers Federation here in Australia. Thanks for talking to Australia Wide.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
You don't have to fit a certain shape or person, or, you know, anyone can do it.
I could see that she was starting to expand because it's a solid piece of wax.
On ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. The Royal Commission into National Natural Disaster Arrangements today heard from a Kangaroo Island resident, Caroline Patterson, who lost her family home in the fire. The fires destroyed dozens of homes on the island and burnt out 96% of Flinders Chase National Park and killed two people. Ms. Patterson said it was quite manic with visitors on Kangaroo Island when the fires hit in January. This, she said, added to the stress of managing what was a horrific fire.
It was the fire that just kept on giving. There were landowners who had that fire come back through burnt forestry land three times and managed to save their house the first time, the second time, and then on the third time they lost their house. They'd moved, they lost a heap of sheep, but they'd moved a herd over to the east of Pandana. The fire, the ravine fire, wiped out half that flock. It was just a horrendous fire. The loss to this community. I've had conversations with people who have said to me, oh, we weren't directly impacted, or but at least we didn't lose our house. But they've lost everything else. They've lost their income, they've lost their pasture, their tools, their vehicles, their machinery, their house and the contents of their house in some cases. Everyone feels like they're doing better than everybody else, whereas really it's impacted the whole community. Small businesses, everybody knows someone who's been directly impacted. You know, half of the families at the Pandana school, those children have been directly impacted. The Western Districts Football Club, the club in the scrub, was lost in the fire. Little shack settlements down at Hanson Bay. Yeah, tough stuff. Everybody loves Kangaroo Island, and they seem to love Australia, but Kangaroo Island really seemed to resonate with people from around the world, and I think it's largely to do with the connection with our beautiful wildlife and our wild places. Local businesses, organisations, churches, we're still getting things arrive. Like last night I had delivered from the community down in the Limestone Coast, or the Narracore area, sorry, doonas for people who had lost their homes. Honestly, the support has been overwhelming. Like Salvation Army, Red Cross, you start naming them and you know you're going to upset someone, but there was so much support. The big change is that it feels like, because of the global pandemic, that perhaps the fire and the climate change issue has been a little bit swept to the side. And I understand the magnitude of COVID-19, and it really scares everybody. But I'm really concerned that a lot of the people who need assistance may be forgotten with the global pandemic. You know, all the sports shut down, the very thing that holds our remoter communities together. They've lost their sports club. They were still out there training, and then COVID-19 came.
Kangaroo Island resident Caroline Patterson, and she was addressing the Royal Commission into National Natural Disaster Arrangements this afternoon.
ABC Australia Wide.
This is our history. This is Australia's history as much as anything.
On ABC Radio.
Water on the brain, or hydrocephalus, affects 1 in 1,000 people in Australia. The most common treatment available is a medical device called a shunt, and it's inserted into the brain to drain fluid, but it has a high failure rate. In a bid to reduce the rates of complications and improve treatment, a registry was set up in 2013 to collect data. But now a lack of funding could see it closed in a matter of weeks, as Erin Semler reports.
Rebecca Austin is shaving her head for her next surgery. The 26-year-old suffers from hydrocephalus, or water on the brain, and has already had 20 neurosurgeries.
So I have a VP shunt, so a ventricular peritoneal shunt, that moves the fluid from my brain to my belly. The shunt doesn't stop me from doing anything. It keeps me alive, so that's handy.
Miss Austin permanently moved from her hometown of Bilawila in central Queensland to Brisbane last year so she can manage her health better.
I think technically when you get a shunt inserted, it could last your whole lifetime. I think you're very lucky if that is the case. Each time the surgeon's like, okay, well, hopefully this one will last your lifetime.
Unfortunately for the hundreds of people who use this medical device, neurosurgeon Brian Owler says they regularly malfunction. They can become blocked, disconnected, or most commonly infected. But they are usually the only option for many people with hydrocephalus.
Shunts have probably the highest failure rate of any device, and the consequences of failure can, you know, be life-threatening, certainly create, you know, neurological deficits and harm to people.
Shunt failures can look different for everyone who uses them. For Miss Austin, headaches are the most common symptom.
When my shunt malfunctions, things kind of build up for me over a period of time, like it could be a period of months. So the other week I had 2 seizures. It's getting towards the end of my shunt being friends with me. It also is causing a lot of problems with my balance at the moment, and has affected my eyes.
In 2013, Professor Owler joined neurosurgeons across the country to establish the Australasian Shunt Registry to keep track of the devices, their failures, and to improve treatment. At the time, the federal government provided $165,000 in funding.
It's been something that's been worked on for more than 10 years, and these registries, you know, are incredibly important in terms of trying to improve outcomes for patients, and particularly around trying to reduce the rates of complications and problems that we see with these shunts, which have real impacts for patients in terms of their health.
Without ongoing funding, the Neurological Society of Australasia says the registry will close on the 1st of July. Andrew Gard is the president of the Hydrocephalus Support Association. He says sufferers view the registry as their only chance at improving treatment in Australia.
It means basically that we just live with even more unknown than we already do.
Professor Owler says losing the registry would be a backward step and is hoping there'll be a solution.
So many people have worked very hard to make the shunt registry happen, so it's disappointing. I understand the Neurosurgical Society, you know, unfortunately doesn't have any other choice but suspended at the moment. But, you know, I'm still hopeful in the future that funding can be found, whether it's through government, industry or some sort of sponsorship, that it can start back up again and, you know, the work won't be wasted.
Erin Semler reporting there, and a Department of Health spokesman says it is open to discussions with the NSA, but the decision to provide funding would be made by the government. It says it was not aware of any formal requests for funding. And that's Australia Wide for this Wednesday. Do remember, you can always email the programme. You may have a story that you think we should look into. AustraliaWide.radio@abc.net.au. I'm Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.